From the right, I'm Matt Lewis.
From the left, I'm Bill Scher.
And you're watching
The Week in Blog.
Good to see you, Bill. Good to see you. We met face-to-face for the first time yesterday.
It was very exciting. Despite talking every week, we've never had a chance to actually shake hands.
I'm in Washington,
D.C. right now in the home offices of Campaign for America's Future, which look more interesting in general than the backdrop of nothing you currently see. I've been for a series of strategy meetings, and since I was in town, I thought the left and the right should get together at where left and right always get together, Starbucks.
That's right, the Starbucks on 18th and I, Farragut West, for those who want to recapture the moment.
Quality coffee and corporate chain means bipartisan heaven.
That's right. That is right. I mean, where else for hipsters to be than Starbucks, right? We didn't even talk about They Might Be Giants. Hey, by the way, do you know Dan Pink? Speaking of hipsters, are you familiar with Daniel Pink?
I'm not.
I think he's on your team. He was a Gore speechwriter, wrote for Wired. He has a new book out that I'm reading now, and I thought maybe you might know him, but I'll let you guys know how it is. His last book was called A Whole New Mind. It was terrific. So it's great. You know, when you're a writer, they just send you these books to review. So I guess I have to review it. But so far, so good. So we have an abbreviated version today because you're meeting with Con Carroll in a little bit. So we're just going to do a save the policy stuff for next week and do some sort of campaign topics real quick. And the first one I wanted to ask you about,
who would have thought there'd be this much campaign stuff to talk about so early in 2010?
Big time, big time. It just keeps coming. This whole year has been that way, where you think there's going to be a slow period, and man, it just keeps coming. But one story that's been interesting has been Harold Ford, obviously former congressman from Tennessee, ran for U.S. Senate, lost. He's a frequent pundit on like MSNBC's Morning Joe. He's on there all the time. And he's going to run against Kirsten Gillibrand for the U.S. Senate seat. And the liberals have circled the wagons. Peter Wiener was sort of mocking him today. I saw him over at Daily Kos saying that his campaign was hatched in the Manhattan offices of Morning Joe. I see Greenwald, Iglesias, Melitzas, Black continue to criticize him. So what's your take on this, Bill? Why is it legitimate and fair that they're coming out after him? And what's up with this?
Well, it's certainly fair. I mean, no one's saying anything inaccurate or untoward. It's not a smear job they're putting on. I mean, they're attacking him for what he's saying. But what's interesting to me about this, and I don't think he hasn't formally announced, correct? He's just merely openly talked about the possibility.
Yeah, I mean, he's talked with the New York Times about the possibility, so
right.
You're right.
He's certainly formal, putting the notion out.
But, right, it's not a very well-hidden secret.
I mean, it's not like, you know, Gillibrand is some huge blog favorite.
Right,
but
exactly.
Ford is like the personification of everything that the liberal blogosphere has been fighting against. The kind of soulless politics, constant phony triangulation, chasing a mythical center. I mean, no one would begrudge someone for running, you know, more to the right than liberals would like in a state like Tennessee, but there's something about the way that Harold Ford does it that seems particularly egregious. And then to come to New York and try to do this total 180 on certain issues in a state where you don't need to be a right-leaning Democrat to win by a long shot.
No, let me ask you. I know he ran the DLC.
He currently runs the DLC.
Okay.
That's the other part of this. I mean, he literally is, the rival in all of this. And as someone who got directly in Marcos's face about what the future of the party should be, and they squared off on Meet the Press,
when I see him now pontificating and doing punditry and all that, he seems to be defending the liberal side.
The other part of this is, so on one hand, Ford is the personification of everything that the left in the blogosphere is fighting against. On the other hand, Ford is this entirely, his entire base is like Morning Joe fans, and Mike Bloomberg's political
circle. Maybe
that's
why I like him. I don't know.
So he's become like a media creation. So it's not just that Ford is a rival of the blogosphere politically, but he's a rival of what a lot of blogs don't like about the media and the kind of people the media upholds as representing the political center without any real basis for that.
I got to tell you that it really feels to me like there is an irrational dislike of this guy, and that he is being hit for things that other people get a pass on, and I just can't figure out why such.
Well, I think
anger.
That's why. I mean, I think there's an emotional reaction to him for what he represents beyond just right-leaning politics, which bloggers have a varying degree of acceptance for depending on, you know, political reality. But the fact that he is DLC chair, which is sort of committed to marginalizing a robust liberalism in the party. The fact that this is New York State, where you have no business of running a DLC candidate there.
But Bill Clinton used to be in the DLC. Al Gore used to be in the DLC.
You know, and there's been a certain tension with the blogosphere. I mean, if you go back to blogosphere, origins, a lot of early bloggers were big Clinton guys and women. I'm using guys, you know, broadly, because they saw Clinton as a fighter. You know, he might not have been a pure liberal, but he was certainly a pugnacious partisan. And they liked that part, and he also represented what they thought was, you know, the quote-unquote village's irrationality towards him, and he showed at what lengths the right would go to in today's politics.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always was sort of an intrinsic love of him, and a lot of early blogging was not about liberal litmus tests. A lot of early bloggers were, you know, big Jim Webb fans, just because he was a fighter, even though he wasn't, you know, liberal orthodox. So it's not just about that, but the DLC, sorry, the current DLC, post-Clinton, has gone out of its way to directly attack liberal bloggers as being the problem, that they are hostile and they're irrational and they're going to destroy the party. And a lot of bloggers think the DLC has been proven wrong, that bloggers have been a positive part overall for Democratic success and moving the political conversation. And so to have Ford, when the DLC is sort of at its lowest point of influence, to then run the New York State primary of all things, and because Joe Scarborough is a fan of his, it pushes every last liberal blogger button out there.
So the big story this week, and what I guess we'll spend the lion's share of our conversation on, is Massachusetts Senate race. You're from Massachusetts? I know you live in Massachusetts.
I am from Massachusetts. Not born and raised, but I live there now.
Where are you from?
I'm sorry?
Where are you from, Massachusetts?
I was born in New York, but I live in Western Massachusetts today.
Okay. Upstate New York or the city?
Westchester County.
Okay. That's the rich area, right?
Living rough on the streets.
So everybody knows what's happening in Massachusetts. Senate race on Tuesday, the 19th, between State Senator Scott Brown and Attorney General Martha Coakley. The race is too close for comfort. Eric Erickson at Red State says if Brown keeps Coakley down to a narrow victory, never mind Brown winning, it'll send shockwaves through Washington, D.C., and probably expedite a wave of retirements. Liberals have been very... on the blogosphere, very critical of Coakley as well. TPM's Josh Marshall says, the most consistent and convincing explanation for why she's not doing so well I've seen is that she was just not visible after the primary, while Brown has been ubiquitous. And Marcos says, Democrats were saddled with a candidate who thought she could nap her way into the Senate. Bill Scheer, what is your take on all of this?
Well, I think the fact is she can nap her way into the Senate. So
you're not worried.
I am personally not worried for her. But I do think, I mean, this is still a fascinating development. I mean, we know very little about where the polling stands. We've seen varying polls. I argued on our last Blogging Heads, watch the Boston Globe poll because they have experience in polling the state. You know, they came out with a 15-point lead for Coakley. Now, there's been blogging at Pollster.com by Mark Blumenthal that has said, even though Rasmussen shows it close, Public Policy, which is a Democratic firm, actually showed Brown up by one, and the Globe showed it by 15 points, wasn't necessarily different because they all had different turnout models. So it wasn't that one's a good pollster, one's a bad pollster. The turnout models are total art and not science. Everyone has to guess what turnout's going to be, particularly in a special election.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think I don't pay attention to any of the polls right now for this race.
Right.
I think it's
impossible. There's been a perception created now after mostly after the Rasmussen poll that conservative bloggers jumped onto and Tea Party activists have been pushing that have created a perception of a close race, rightly or wrongly, and that has changed. And it's pushed all of Democratic buttons, because Democrats are pessimists at heart, pushed all their fear buttons that this thing is going down and what should be a lock, when it might well still be a lock.
Right.
But perception is perception.
Well, speaking of that, what you just said about liberals, Digby said, if Martha Coakley loses, it will be very hard for progressives, worse than we can imagine. After the so-called lessons of Virginia and New Jersey, there will be no fighting back the perception that the party is in big trouble, regardless of whether it's true. And it's hard to argue that point that it isn't. So, I mean, let's say Coakley wins a narrow victory. What do you think the fallout's going to be?
Well, a narrow victory would be bad for sort of political perception is concerned. I mean, obviously she'd have the Senate seat. Democrats would still have effectively 60 votes. They wouldn't have a problem getting the health care bill passed and the like. But as far as what that health care vote means to what comes next on the legislative calendar, it's going to make the party feel like, holy crap, if this bill has altered the political climate that Massachusetts is now a swing state, why should I stick my neck out for anything else in the legislative calendar? We're going to have to pull back. Now, that perception might then get scrambled again if they pass the bill and everyone poll numbers pop up once the Democratic talking points become more coordinated. But that would be the immediate reaction. So I don't know if it has to be a double-digit win to avoid that. Would a 7-8-9-point win be sufficient for people to feel comfortable or what? I don't know. But there'll definitely be there'll be a fair amount of spinning on the related to what the margin is of what it means to the Obama agenda and how it has helped to hurt the Democratic Party.
So now you live in Massachusetts. So Coakley is running a what I would describe as a negative campaign. Empirically, I think that's fair to say. Brown has been running a positive campaign. I don't think he's running any negative ads.
I don't know if that's totally true. I don't know the ad stream, mm-hmm. But he certainly made negative comments about her.
He's been endorsed by some police unions. He's endorsed by Doug Flutie. He's endorsed by what's his name, the pitcher from the Red Sox, whose name
Kurt
is
Schilling.
Me right now. Kurt Schilling, the bloody sock guy. He's endorsed by the NRA and the Chamber of Commerce. I know Barack Obama just cut a TV ad for Coakley. Vicky Kennedy ran an ad for Coakley. I mean, how do you see, is there any danger that he will be portrayed, any danger for her that he's going to be portrayed as like this outsider? And by the way, the other story, the backdrop of this is the big New York Times today had a story that talked about how Coakley was sort of mocking the fact that Brown was standing out in front of Fenway Stadium in the cold, shaking hands. And she was making the strategic point that there isn't enough time in this truncated campaign for it to matter if you campaign retail.
I don't think she was being mocking. I think she was just trying to defend her own schedule and saying, look, there's just, you can't shake everybody's hand on a truncated campaign schedule and have it matter. You gotta have, an air war. You can't do it on a ground war.
Not to say that's a smart comment for her to make,
but I don't think she was trying to mock Brown for what he was doing.
Okay, well, in any event, I don't necessarily think she's wrong, but she was stupid to say it.
Probably. I mean, sometimes you shake your hands just to get the image of you shaking hands
exactly.
to get on TV stations.
So, but what's your take now? I mean, like, you live there. Are you seeing any, is there any backlash that she's, like, an insider establishment? Or, I mean, this is, I guess, going to be a low turnout affair, so.
I mean, I think two things are happening, from what I can tell from, you know, anecdotal interactions I have with my fellow New Englanders. I think, you know, she is getting the rep of being a bad candidate.
Right. And that's the same. That's the same rep, by the way, that Virginia candidate, what's his name? He lost to Bob McDonnell a month ago.
Oh, I've already forgotten his name. He was such a bad candidate.
Whoever so quickly
Cray
we forget.
Cray Deeds.
That's exactly. If you remember, though, and this could be concerning because that's exactly the Democrats. I think the Obama administration started floating that out, that he had run a bad campaign.
Well, they started floating that out when the polling said he was a sure loser, and they wanted that to be the narrative on election
right.
night.
So do you think, is there a chance that they're sort of paving the way for a soft fall if she loses?
I mean, people will say, I don't think that's what's happening. I mean, the strategy of the Democratic establishment has been to play up that it is a tight race to goad the Democratic base to show up and give money.
Right.
Because the concern is not that Massachusetts has really swung to the right, is that it's going to be a low turnout race, and if the Democratic base doesn't show up,
right.
what
and the
base
intensity is,
this will carry the day. So I think what's happening on the Democratic side of things is that on the ground, people are grousing that Coakley's a bad candidate. But they've always groused that John Kerry's a bad candidate, and he keeps winning statewide elections there. So I'm not
Have
sure
they really?
The
wait, I didn't. Wait, this is new to me. So you're saying that it's. In Massachusetts, it's always been thought that John Kerry is a poor candidate.
Everybody hates John Kerry.
In Massachusetts.
Oh, there is no John Kerry love in Massachusetts. Historically in Massachusetts, at the end of the day, the D at the end of your name is much more important than your charisma. And so what's happening right now is the message is being sent out that you can't take the special election for granted. You do not want Massachusetts to send a Republican to the Senate in Ted Kennedy's seat, so you better damn well show up and vote whether you like Martha Coakley or not. And
by the way, Bill, that's not Ted Kennedy's seat. That's the people's seat.
I've heard that somewhere.
I paid for this microphone.
So I suspect that the turnout models are going to be like normal turnout models. I mean, perhaps lower because it's still a special, but not greatly skewed in proportion than normal. I mean, Brown's probably best shot was to sneak up on Martha
right.
Coakley and the Democratic establishment. And this is maybe the upside for blogs is they could give Brown attention and a sense of perceived possibility and to get nationwide money being sent to him. But
yeah.
the flip side of that is that he can't play a sneak attack.
Unintended consequences. Okay, I know you got to get your fancy inside the Beltway dinner with Con Carroll, but I wanted to ask you, and since I know you've been in meetings all day, so if you're not ready to answer this, don't. But I know that there was some sort of deal that's cut that would exempt unions from the Cadillac, you know, from the tax on Cadillac healthcare plans. I don't have any blogger stuff, but. Do you know
I heard that in the
this?
Hallway too, and I haven't read the details of it yet to know if that is a locked. Tight deal or a trial balloon.
So I'm guessing that'll be on next week's The Weekend blog.
But I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how the liberal blogosphere reacts to that, because I do think there's been a growing discontent with the bill in the liberal blogosphere. You know, the insurance tax was part of it. You know, part of it was they didn't want to see working families be unfairly impacted, and so if unions are getting a carve-out, that would at least partially mitigate that, but it might not totally mitigate it. I don't know enough about the policy to be able to say what the substantive consequence of that is. But there are other issues that liberal bloggers have with the bill, so I don't know if that in itself would appease them. But I think on the whole... For Obama, for the Democratic Congress, it's going to matter most if they get the bill passed, even if there are compromises along the way that result in certain backlash, like the deal that Ben Nelson got on Medicaid funding for Nebraska. I'm betting at the end of the day that's going to matter that they got a bill passed, when that moment happens, when the Democrats have coordinated messaging and they're communicating what is in the bill, it's going to help families, and there's not confusion and disagreement about what that is, to see how well that victory lap is taken, to see if that results in a bump in the polls, that's what's going to matter most.
Another big issue that happened this week was obviously the Haiti tragedy. And
there's a lot of blogging on both left and right in support of the victims there, although I know there's been some right-wing talk radio and TV from Pat Robertson that has caught the liberal ire. Have conservative bloggers been making controversial comments like that?
No, that's the point I wanted to make. I think that both sides, if you look at the blogosphere and Twitter, that it's been very positive to see the response and the how conservatives and liberals have used Twitter and jointly retweeting each other sometimes in terms of donating, where to donate for relief. So I think that's been a very positive sign. Sometimes the internet is looked at as a very difficult, mean-spirited place, but I think in this instance you have a great example where, you know, conservatives and liberals have come together to be on the right side of the topic. So,
but it's actually interesting, and I do have a little bit of time before I have to meet Cobb, but so forgive me for exploring this. So you are not seeing conservative blogs people picking up the Pat Robertson baton
and saying,
yes, Haiti has been cursed by God because they made a pact with the devil.
No, not at all. I mean, look, the web is worldwide, and I'm sure that there some place is somebody who agrees with that, but I have not seen anybody agreeing with that. And in fact, the conservative blogs that I've seen, people have been critical of that. I, you know, some people have defended him maybe in the sense of, I think Joe Scarborough even defended him to a certain degree. Maybe, you know, sort of, well, I'd have to go back and look. I don't want to misquote him, but maybe it was just like, this is an old guy who, you know, I know what it was. Now that I think of it, Scarborough was making the point that Pat Robertson's, one of his charitable organizations, is actually doing a lot to help Haitians. And the other thing is, you know, Franklin Graham's group, that's Billy Graham's son, Franklin Graham, has a group called Samaritan's Purse, which does a tremendous amount of positive, good humanitarian work all over the world, and they're doing a lot on this. So it's just unfortunate when, you know, if people can mischaracterize Christians or evangelicals or whatever based on one unfortunate comment like that. Because there is a lot of Christians, a lot of evangelicals out there who care deeply. I mean, look at people like Michael Gerson. You know, whether you like him or not, you know, his heart is obviously on Africa, you know, and there's a big strain of that sort of what I would call neoconservatism, actually, that is very, very interested in places like Africa and AIDS and malaria and feel very called, you know. Great movie, I don't know if you saw it, called Amazing Grace, which I just rewatched over Christmas, about William Wilberforce, who ended the slave trade. That was a movie that I think liberals and conservatives jointly, for different reasons, liked. And there were a lot of evangelical conservatives who very much see themselves, you know, Wilberforce was a animal rights activist, also a born-again Christian. So oftentimes I think that it's that point is missed.
Well, I mean, it seems like perhaps this is another stage of the conservative blogosphere trying to modernize the movement and maybe try to shake off some of the old-timey craziness that sometimes turns the face of the movement. And I wonder if perhaps it would be elevated to say, look, this guy does not represent us. We're here to help victims. We're not here to kick them when they're down.
And there's nothing inherently, I mean, there's nothing, like, when conservative bloggers say that what Pat Robertson said was wrong, or at least when we espouse a different viewpoint, there's nothing anti-conservative about that. I mean, there's nothing inherently conservative about what Pat Robertson was saying. I mean, keep in mind the injection of sort of the religious right into the conservative movement is a fairly modern phenomenon. And I think what he said was not ideologically conservative at all. I don't think it was liberal either. I just don't think it certainly didn't fit. You know, it's not like Edmund Burke or, you know, whomever would have, you know, that was out of conservative dogma.
I mean, I wouldn't even call it Christian, because I doubt there's anything in the Bible about how Haiti was cursed.
Yeah, you know, it's a whole theological discussion, but I just feel like that if you're a caring person, whether you're a Christian or not, but if you're a caring person, when look, I am very. Then there are some people who right now are saying, not bloggers, but I've just heard, you know, on talk radio callers say things like, well, everybody puts down America except for now when they need us. But, you know, I'm actually very proud that we are a country that we are there when bad things happen. We will show up and help. And I don't care whether Barack Obama is the president or George W. Bush is the president. I am proud of America when we come to the aid of people in need.
Now, I wouldn't expect bloggers to get political in the midst of a disaster situation, but just out of curiosity, are there conservative bloggers who are saying, hey, Obama's doing a good job with crisis response here, and he's making America proud by taking the lead here? Or are people saying, hey, this is not America's responsibility, we're not the world's aid fund? Are people even naming that issue at all?
I would say that the general conservative viewpoint on blogosphere has been neither. They're neither praising him for doing a good job, nor are they saying this is not America's responsibility. What I'm seeing a lot of is, let's help these folks. Let's send money. Let's, you know, give to the Red Cross or whatever humanitarian organizations there. That's what I'm seeing. It's not blaming him. It's not praising him. Now, I'm sure that what always happens is that politics creeps in more as time goes on. And I think that the Obama administration is likely going to try to exploit this instance a little bit politically. I understand that Joe Biden is on a trip or going on a trip to Louisiana. Some people would speculate that might call attention to George W. Bush's miserable failure during Katrina and juxtapose it toward what's happening in Haiti. But on the other hand, President Obama has enlisted George W. Bush's help, along with President Clinton, to sort of be ambassadors of this humanitarian effort. So, you know, I'm sure the more that time goes on, the more that both sides will start politicizing it. But so far, I think it's just conservative bloggers and people on Twitter have mostly just been saying, here's how we can help. And what's great is to see retweeting things. Like, you'll have someone from like a mainstream media, you know, someone at the New York Times or ABC or whatever, will tweet, you know, donate here, and you'll see conservatives on Twitter retweeting that and encouraging their followers. I'm sure it's happening on the other side too.
Very interesting.
Yeah, man. Always. I guess we'll end on a kind of down note. I mean, it's a very, very troubling, difficult thing in the world right now, and. But I'm glad we're pulling together on this one, and you know, we can fight it out over Martha Coakley.
And come everyone together. Come over. I'll be back in Massachusetts next week. Everyone, come up and watch the fireworks.
Yeah, we could have a little get together or something.
You have no plans to cover the race?
Not on the ground. Out? Not on the ground. I'll go. You know, I mean, I'll obviously be in places like New Hampshire and Iowa for the presidential, but I've never set foot in Massachusetts.
If you change your mind and want to do an on the ground report, there's always a bid for you at Shea Share.
I appreciate that, man. Now, would you like? Let me ask you. Would obviously it's a statewide race. It's a Senate race, so it's, you know, you would obviously be in the district. But in terms of being a swing area or being an area that would be of interest. Is where you live, would that be sort of in the thick of things?
Where I am is in the more sparsely populated part of the state that is historically the more conservative part, but has some extremely deep blue pockets, of which is one that I live in. But you wouldn't have to drive too far.
It would be, if the map of it would be your house, it would
right.
be the deep blue pocket.
Which would have, you wouldn't have to drive too far to get into, you know, rural areas where you're going to find, you know, some real bona fide conservatives. You know, there was
wow.
there was a tea party not too about 20 minutes from my house.
Did you go to cover it?
I did not personally go. I do know someone who did.
All right, buddy. Well, good talking to you. Good seeing you yesterday. Say hi to Con for me. Eat a steak or vegetarian meal or whatever. And next week we'll be back with a regularly scheduled The Weekend blog where we will delve into policy issues.
And maybe size up the Massachusetts Senate race after it's over.
Yes, we will have a postmortem of that. Check us out on Twitter at The Weekend Blog, on Facebook / The Weekend Blog. And all right, man. Well, good to see you. We'll keep an eye on Massachusetts. We'll keep an eye on Haiti, and we'll keep an eye on Harold Ford. And we'll see you next week. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.